This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 Monday afternoon, March 18th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Legal betting for March Madness is poised to set records in the U.S. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, major changes are coming to the realty industry as home builders are feeling a little bit more optimistic about the spring and summer buying seasons. Welcome in Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Drew, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us today. Home builder sentiment is pushing higher, despite the fact that we're still dealing with 6 and 7% mortgage rates. A year ago, if you said that to people in the real estate business, they'd shudder. But at the same time, people have money to burn, and they have to have some place to live.
Yeah, that's such a great question, and I appreciate being on here today. Realistically, what we're seeing is there's a lot less builders that are lowering their prices. So that's always attractive and good to hear that the people, you know, the builders are not lowering their prices to attract some buyers, because that used to be the way it was. So even though the interest rates are kind of coming up, people are still out there and they're not using the sales incentives that they used to do to attract people to come out and get these homes.
So the demand is there. People are still willing to buy despite the fact that the rates are higher. Now, what does this mean not only for the home builders, but for people who buy and sell homes?
I think that's interesting, too, because that's where right now the interest rates are kind of doing their thing. I think that 7% is where we're kind of stabilizing right now. It's not, we're not having that frenzy that we had before. We're seeing a stabilizing of the market. So people are starting to enter the market as the spring comes. People are getting excited about, okay, this is going to be the new norm of what we're going to see. And they're going to get out there and start doing these things. And I think with the Fed's talking about potentially lowering the rates a couple more times this year, I think it's going to really attract and drive more people into the market space.
Now, speaking of buying and selling homes, there is an earthquake that's about to pass through the real estate business, and that is the end of the 6% commission split evenly between the buyers and the seller's agents. That may go away. It's part of the settlement of a lawsuit on the part of the National Association of Realtors. Now, with this commission structure going away, how is that going to change the way people can buy or sell a home?
What it's going to really do, Rob, is it's going to change the way that the commission structure is scheduled. I mean, right now they're talking about paying that 5 and 6% interest where the sellers are paying the buyer's commissions. So I think you're going to see people negotiating these rates with the different brokers, whether they be sellers and or buyers. And I think it's going to impact the way that people now do this. And I think it's going to change the cost to them, making things maybe a little bit more affordable. In trying to steer away and stop from that steering piece where people are, the realtors are directing people to say, hey, go see this house because of the fact that the commission that they're getting paid is higher. I think that's really what they're trying to squash right now.
And when you talk about how the commission is going to be negotiated, is that the responsibility now of the home buyer or the home seller, or will the agents talk it amongst themselves?
It's going to be you know, industry-wide. The buyers and sellers, I think, are going to become more educated, and I think that's necessary to the process because that'll help them really understand what's happening. But I think the realtors themselves will start to do and derive different programs, whether they go to a set fee schedule where they're saying, hey, my fee is going to be X for doing this, or they negotiate those commissions back and forth to make it a comfortable situation for the buyers and sellers. It's going to really affect the lending, too.
And then very quickly, Drew, what is this going to mean for people who are in the real estate business, either full time or just selling homes on the side as an additional source of family income?
That's going to be interesting because I think really what that is going to determine is I think there's going to definitely be a lessening of the realtors. I think there's going to be a lot more realtors kind of falling out of that space because it's not going to be as easy to do this as short term as what a lot of them are doing right now.
Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, legal sports books gear up for an avalanche of March Madness wagers.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The fields are set for the NCAA men's and women's basketball tournaments. Let's talk about the madness of sports betting in March with Dave Foreman, Vice President of Research with the American Gaming Association in Washington. Dave, thank you for joining us today. And I would imagine outside of the Super Bowl, March Madness has to be the biggest gambling period of the year.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me. And you're almost right. In fact, you know, even including the Super Bowl, March Madness is by far the biggest sporting betting event of the year for people. You know, we think about $2.7 billion is going to be bet across the men's and women's tournament over the next few weeks. And that's almost double the amount that was bet legally on the Super Bowl a few months ago.
Now, of that $2 billion, is that wagered consistently across the run of both tournaments from start to the end of one shining moment? Or is the bulk of the activity in the first and second rounds?
You know, we don't actually have a good sense from the state regulators, the data they release when that money's bet. A lot of it is front loaded over those first few days. And I think the interesting angle this year is the increasing popularity of the women's tournaments. I mean, you saw MGM earlier today said that they'd seen 2.5 times the amount of bets placed already just on the women's tournament this year than they had in the past. So I think that's driving a lot of interest this year that we haven't seen in the past.
So is this another element of the Caitlin Clark effect on women's college basketball?
Absolutely. I think she's probably the biggest factor, but I think you've seen people getting more interested in the women's game over the past few years, and she's been a big catalyst, but people are being drawn to that, and the increased level of competition you've seen in the women's game compared to how it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago when it was really dominated by one or two schools.
And then from the information that you're getting from state regulators about who is betting what and where, is it primarily app-based betting? Is that where the bulk of the action is taking place, or are people going to brick-and-mortar casinos and placing bets in sports books?
It is absolutely primarily driven by online or app-based betting. That's how people want to bet, so they can get bet with their friends either at home or at a bar or a watch party. You know, something like 92% of all the money bet in the United States is bet on an app, although I suspect for the tournament you'll see a little bit more money bet in person just because it is such kind of a big event for people. You know, people play hooky from work over the next few days to watch it. So I think you'll see a bit more in-person betting on the tournament than you do in general.
And there's kind of a small sample size of legal March Madness wagering coast to coast. I mean, even before the Supreme Court decision, you basically had to go to Las Vegas to bet on the tournament legally. But are you starting to discover in the years since the Supreme Court decision that you need that Cinderella team to make things more interesting and make things potentially a lot more lucrative for those who gamble more often than others?
You know, a compelling storyline always helps. Unfortunately, you know, we don't have data on going back for too many years right now because, again, it is such a new market. And so much of the betting used to be done kind of casually or socially on brackets at office pools and stuff like that. And it's only very recently that people now have the ability to bet, you know, real money on single individual games. So, you know, again, more excitement drives more betting for sure. But unclear if a Cinderella drives a bigger handle on the game.
Dave Foreman, Vice President of Research with the American Gaming Association in Washington. Thank you for joining us today to preview March Madness wagering. Selection Sunday was last night, and the tournament games get underway starting on Thursday. That's when the round of 64 steps into action. Thanks for joining us today, Dave. Coming up next, a potential factor in the Bears stadium plans that hasn't gotten much attention up to this point. We'll tell you what it is.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Personal seat licenses could factor into the Bears' plans for a new stadium on the lakefront. Let's discuss the possible impact with Danny Ecker, reporter for Crane Chicago Business. Danny, thank you for joining us today. And for those who are unfamiliar with the idea, you hear about PSLs or personal seat licenses with regards to season ticket holders at Bears games. What is a personal seat license and how does it work?
Yeah, so the personal seat license, pretty simple, really. It's just you're paying for the right to buy tickets, to season tickets to the Bears, and there's other perks usually that come with, you know, maybe first access to other events. For example, at Soldier Field, they sold personal seat licenses, and these are, you know, thousands of dollars. They're transferable. You can sell them, and they get sold on a regular basis. And for teams that are building new stadiums, they are a great way to raise a lot of money to help finance those stadiums.
And as the Bears promised to pitch in $2 billion in private financing to any publicly financed stadium in the city of Chicago, the PSLs were certainly be a big chunk of that private revenue, as was the case 20 years ago when they remodeled Soldier Field.
Right. The Bears had used about $50 million or so from PSL sales back in 2002. This has been a standard financing tool for teams. If you look at the last, you know, five or six NFL stadiums built, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. In Las Vegas, they raised almost $600 million through PSL sales for the toward the construction of Allegiant Stadium there, which was almost a $2 billion stadium. And so I think when people hear about $2 billion that the Bears have pledged in private money toward this stadium effort, as they are looking at, you know, the area just south of Soldier Field, you know, there's a good chunk of that. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars likely would come from PSL sales. So among other pieces to that, you just have to always keep in mind that, well, it's not necessarily the McCaskey family reaching into their own pockets to say, here's what we're going to put in. It's oftentimes, a good portion of this is on the backs of season ticket holders.
The PSL discussion we're having right now is a potential financing instrument for the next Chicago Bears stadium. This is strictly for the stadium that is proposed in the south parking lot of Soldier Field along the lakefront. But I'm guessing if they were to circle back to Arlington Heights, PSLs would be a part of that equation as well.
No question. I mean, this is, again, become a standard tool. If you look at the Buffalo Bills, they just broke ground last summer on a brand new stadium. They were expected to raise $100 to $200 million from PSL sales. This is something that's just part of the calculation here. You know, it's a significant piece in addition to things like naming rights to a stadium that would generate a lot of revenue over a long period of time. Things that just are not from taxpayers, but, you know, come from things that the Bears need to be able to raise money for, to be able to help pay off any kind of bond debt or other debt that's taken on for a stadium, either in the city or in Arlington Heights.
Danny Ecker, reporter, Crane Chicago Business, thank you for the update on the Bears' desire for a stadium in the city of Chicago, one just south of Soldier Field. Still ahead, why some couples are keeping a tight budget for their weddings, plus a couple of suggestions from our Monday stock picker.
This is Chicago's News, Traffic, and Weather Station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The city of Chicago makes some moves involving the status of migrants in shelters. The leading candidates for U.S. president continue their work on the campaign trail. As the spring wedding season rolls in, some people are opting to hold the line on costs. It's Stock Picker Monday. We'll get a pair of suggestions from an investing pro. WBBM Business, the market are higher. The Dow is up 162 points, the NASDAQ is up 178, and the S&P 500 is up 46. We have 32 degrees right now at O'Hare with snow flurries at 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. It's expected that over 2,000 migrants in Chicago will be evicted from their current shelters by the end of the month. 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez criticizing the move.
All of this is just smoke and mirrors by this administration just to buy more and more time in the hopes that at some point post-November, that if Joe Biden is reelected, there'll be millions upon millions of dollars in federal help coming to the city to address this.
The city's Office of Emergency Management and Communications estimates that somewhere under 11,000 migrants remain in shelters. President Biden and former President Trump continue to campaign ahead of November's election. The latest from CBS News correspondent Skylar Henry.
Some are questioning former President Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail, referring to January 6th rioters as hostages.
They've been treated terribly and very unfairly.
The Biden campaign seized on this moment, slamming Trump, who at a rally in Ohio said this after talking about tariffs on Chinese-made cars.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath.
Join us for live coverage of the Illinois primary when the polls close at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. You can find a complete voter guide on our homepage, WBBMNewsRadio.com. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are gaining ground today. We welcome in Jim Awad, Senior Managing Director, Clearstate Advisors in New York. Jim, thank you for joining us today. And after a couple of days of selling, especially at the end of last week, the markets are starting off the new week on a positive note. And is this strictly, once again, the market defaulting to NVIDIA and the promise of AI?
AI is going to accelerate the productivity and growth of the economy. The question is, what companies are the winners? What companies are the users? And what is the fair valuation? And as the market sort through that, this morning when you had the discussion of negotiations between Apple and Alphabet, Google, on joint installing the Google AI app on Apple phones, that reignited interest in those two stocks and in technology and AI in general. And of course, NVIDIA conference, which starts today and it's going to last several days, some are calling the Woodstock of artificial intelligence. And what they say, what the products are, and who the winners and losers are and how the stocks react are going to be crucial to this week's market action.
In pinning all of your hopes essentially on one sector of technology, and granted it's a transformative technology, artificial intelligence, are there risks associated with it that that the reality is not going to match the promise that is being placed on it right now by investors?
Well, we've lived through this movie before in the late 90s. The difference is that this time you're dealing with real companies making real money. Now, on the risk of relying too much on one sector, of course there's that risk, and that sector can't do well if the rest of the economy does well. So what you've noticed in the markets the last few weeks, you have had a broadening out effect where the rest of the stock market has done as well as the technology stocks after a period of underperformance. So in your best case scenario, technology continues to lead the economy higher, and the rest of the stock market gets carried along. But if the fundamentals deteriorated for the U.S. economy, AI couldn't carry the stock market and the economy alone.
We're talking about the today's market activity with Jim Awad, Senior Managing Director, Clearstate Advisors in New York. One number and one event this week that I see them as being interrelated up to a certain point, and that is we do have the Fed policy meeting this week. We're not expecting any changes in interest rates, no cuts, and certainly no hikes. But at the same time, the Home Builder Sentiment Survey came out today, and home builders feeling the best they have in quite some time because the housing market is undeterred by higher interest rates. People are willing to spend through these higher rates. And does that change the Fed's calculus?
Well, it speaks to the ability of the American consumer to power through higher interest rates based on a strong labor market. And here's how it could affect the Fed. Based on the last 2 months, inflation has stopped going down and is moving sideways. So the question is, it moving sideways on the way to again gradually declining towards 2%, or is it sideways on the cusp of raising again and forcing the Fed to potentially consider raising rates? And so I think the Fed should proceed and view this data with caution, and I would expect a press conference that's non-committal and leaving the Fed with a wide variety of options. The question is, will the dot plots change? There is some saying that they will increase a forecast for the growth of the economy and increase the forecast for inflation, which means that the number of rate cuts will diminish if that's true.
It seems like the analogy right now is, do you want to slam on the brakes or do you want to gently glide to a stop, just take your foot off the accelerator as you approach the toll plaza, as it were?
Yeah, well, the Fed clearly would like to reduce rates.
They may or may not have that option based on the data over the next coming months, but their best action is to remain optionality, remain flexible, and don't commit to a lot.
Jim Awad, Senior Managing Director, Clearstead Advisors in New York, thank you for joining us today. Coming up, some couples are deciding not to break the bank when planning a wedding.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The average cost of a wedding broke $30,000 for the first time last year. That's according to the research company The Wedding Report. However, some couples are opting out of the Big Bucks Bash. Let's talk about getting value for the vows with Ed Jertsen, certified financial planner and founder of the Engage Wealth Group based in Chicago. The website, theengagewealthgroup.com. Ed, thank you for joining us today. And this is as much of a wedding tradition as the first dance, and that is kind of calculating your estimated costs after you get engaged. And that is that may let some of the romance out of the balloon, but it could also present an interesting challenge.
Yeah, Rob, the goal here is not to have your fairy tale wedding ending in a financial nightmare. I mean, if you look at the sheer cost of weddings going back pre-pandemic, I mean, they're up year over year, 17% on average. And what that means for couples in 2024, that average wedding expense could exceed $40,000. So this is not an inexpensive endeavor in terms of tying the knot.
Now, what are some of the things that cost the most and that people are scaling back on in order to knock that final number down?
Well, the sheer cost is just the people and the guests and the eating and the potential beverages and those kind of things that you share. That's where it gets really expensive. And even those looking at trying to get away, whether it's a domestic destination wedding or international wedding, those actually cost more. So looking at like what your spending plan is and what you really want to accomplish for this one day is really important. And then potentially, again, we always have to be aware of parents and the parents' desire to contribute, making sure that they don't financially impale themselves as well.
Now, has social media made things more expensive as far as weddings are concerned? Because when my wife and I got married 13 years ago, this was before Instagrammable moments. These were the dark ages when you just shared your thoughts on Facebook and nothing else. But has the rise of Instagram and TikTok led people to do more expensive things just for the spectacle?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it, Andy. Rob, in terms of just the envy part, right? This is what we want. This is the big show. This is what we want to do. And kind of keeping up with your friends, neighbors, and those folks on Instagram that you follow may or may not be, again, the best and highest use of your time. But really sitting down and figuring out, do we want to spend $40,000 on a wedding today or cut that back and maybe use some of those monies for a down payment on our house or for planning for future finances? And again, that's the hard part because of the social pressures to put on such a big, elaborate event.
It seems like you can save the most money by culling the guest list, because if it is $200 ahead, and that's just for dinner, that's before you factor in whether you have an open bar or whether you have a dessert cart or other things. If you have 150 people versus 200, you're going to save some serious coin.
Yeah, I want to be real careful here, Rob, in terms of staying in my non-wedding planning lane. But ultimately, there's a lot of different things that you can do and look at ways of saving money, right? It doesn't have to be in that high-end venue. It could be different venues, the wedding list. So again, starting with the financial side and what your budget is, what you have, now you can really start to become more creative. Maybe you have less people in a less formal setting, or more people in a more formal setting, or however it works out in terms of the logic, that's the key. Start with what the spending plan is first, and then start and keep within those parameters. And that way, you're putting yourselves on a good financial footing right out of the gate.
And the reality is, I mean, and this is once again above and beyond the personal finance component of this conversation, Ed, but whether you have 10 peacocks, 5 peacocks, or no peacocks at your wedding ceremony or reception, you're just as married.
You know what? It's a good point. We never want to take that special a day away from anyone. As you said, it's very entrenched in sort of the United States in terms of weddings and elaborate, but you can look across the planet, Rob, and see how other people do it as well. And some are even more on the top end of things. But ultimately, again, really itemize what's important to you, right? Is it having, you know, 200 people with 14 peacocks, or is it just a core group of people that really will support you now and for the rest of your life? Because as you mentioned, at the end of the day, you know, you're still exchanging vows and off you go.
Ed Jurtzen, certified financial planner, founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online at engagewealthgroup.com. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, a pair of picks from our Monday afternoon stock picker.
Your daily transaction for useful information. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Hey, it's Stock Picker Monday. Helping us out today is our first stock picker in the history of the Noon Business Hour, Pat Morrow, President, Patrick Morrow Investment Advisors in Oak Brook. Pat, thank you for joining us today and putting on the spurs one more time. You got two selections today, and they both come from the defense space.
Well, the first one does. Raytheon Corporation is now RTX Corporation, and best known for its production of the Tomahawk cruise missile from submarines and warships. The other product and another division, Pratt & Whitney, which makes five jet engines for various aircraft. And the one that I'm keying in on now is the jet engine for the Airbus A320neo family of single-aisle jets. Their biggest competition is Boeing. Boeing, for the last 6 years, has run into, to put it mildly, a lot of problems. And I think an educated guess is that the Airbus sales will dominate in this sector. And the jet engine of choice for the Airbus is the Pratt & Whitney geared turbojet. And it is quiet and fuel efficient, and it's the reason it's favored. So I'm looking for a good performance from RTX Corporation.
So this is the parent company of Raytheon, which is the defense contractor, and Pratt & Whitney, which big aerospace company, all part of the RTX umbrella, the symbol RTX. And your next one is in home environment systems.
Well, Watsco Inc. is the name of the company, WSO on the New York Stock Exchange. This is the largest distributor of air conditioning and refrigeration in the country. This is an industry that's highly fractured. There are literally thousands of distributors of this product. Watsco does not make air conditioners or refrigerators. It distributes them. And their business since 1989 has just gone from $64 million in sales to now over $7 billion. And they in Chicago, 3 years ago, they bought Temperature Equipment Corporation out of Morton Grove, which does about $300 to $400 million a year in sales. So, and they have a very efficient platform where the contractors, it's very easy for them. It's easier than Facebook or TikTok or whatever. I mean, it's unbelievable. And this is the reason for their success, in my opinion.
Pat Morrow, President, Patrick Morrow Investment Advisors in Oak Brook, thank you for joining us on this Stock Picker Monday. His selections this week, RTX Corporation, the ticker symbol RTX, and Watsco, which is WSO. If you missed any part of today's Noon Business Hour, we'll have the replay podcast available shortly at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Odyssey app.